Welcome to Statewide, reports and conversations from in and around Illinois. I'm Sean Crawford. Ahead, we will talk about the election and the candidates for governor in Illinois. Also, we'll tell you about a ballot measure that could change the state's constitution, the arguments for and against it. The Department of Children and Family Services still struggles to adopt reforms laid out in a federal court decree. We'll hear how some other states are handling child welfare. A small flower that is a threatened species will go on the hunt for it in central Illinois. We'll also learn how students with special needs had their education impacted by the pandemic, and a story of addiction and recovery. We'll listen to a man who found a way out. His story, that's still ahead. Stay with us this hour for Statewide. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Coming up, COVID-19 changed education, how students with special needs have been impacted. Also, the Illinois Department of Children and Family Services has had its share of problems. We'll hear how some other states handle child welfare. And a man who struggled with addiction, but is now an example of recovery, how he helps others. We'll have those stories and more ahead this hour. Illinois voters this fall are being asked whether the state's constitution should be changed to guarantee all workers the right to collectively bargain. And as Alex Degman reports, supporters think it will help create better working conditions for everyone. Opponents see fiscal calamity.
Proponents say the idea, which they call the Workers' Rights Amendment, is simple. They think everyone working in Illinois should have the right to, quote, organize and to bargain collectively through representatives of their own choosing. The amendment would codify the rights of private and public sector workers to negotiate wages, working conditions, and more. Joe Bowen is communications director for the Vote Yes for Workers' Rights campaign. His mother worked as a non-union factory worker as he was growing up, and he remembers the raise that she got when a union shop opened down the street.
The company that my mother worked at decided, hey, we need to do something to compete and keep these employees who keep our business running. And they ended up giving my mom the largest raise that she got in her entire life.
Illinois is not a right-to-work state. That means some employees can be required to join a union, but it doesn't apply to everyone. Agriculture workers, independent contractors, and most notably, public sector workers aren't covered. Bowen and unions want voters to check yes on the ballot to cover those workers, and the amendment would cement union rights in the Constitution rather than just under state law that would protect pro-union rights from the whims of legislatures and governors. Bowen says ensuring union rights makes economic sense.
Union workers are an incredible benefit to our economy here in Illinois. If you're a member of a union, you make about 15% more on average than your non-union counterpart. You're more likely to have health care.
But therein lies part of the problem for some detractors. Who pays for this?
I am Miley Smith, and I am the staff attorney and the director of labor policy at Illinois Policy Institute.
The Illinois Policy Institute is an advocacy group that lobbies for less government and taxes. It's been among the amendment's loudest detractors, noting several flaws. For one, the amendment purports to protect a worker's economic welfare, but that's not defined. It would prohibit lawmakers from passing something that, quote, interferes with, negates, or diminishes the right of employees to organize and bargain collectively.
They could never limit the subjects of bargaining at the table. They could never limit the duration of contracts. We've seen 10-year contracts in Chicago, in some school districts. So lawmakers could never say, oh, you know, that's a bad idea.
Taken as a whole, Smith says the amendment will lead to higher costs.
There's no limit on what government leaders can be forced to give away because of the powerful strikes that we will see. It's going to drive up the cost of government. And who's going to be forced to pay for that? That's the taxpayers.
Joe Bowen with the Vote Yes for Workers' Rights campaign thinks that's hogwash.
The Workers' Rights Amendment has nothing to do with taxes. This is a deceptive attack being pushed by our opponents to try to confuse folks and scare them out of supporting workers' rights.
Jacob Hubert is executive director of the Liberty Justice Center, which works with the Illinois Policy Institute on a wide range of matters. Hubert's group fought the amendment for months because they believe it's unconstitutional. They challenged it in court and tried to get a judge to block it from appearing on the ballot.
A state law that is preempted by federal law violates the Supremacy Clause of the U.S. Constitution. And so that's why we argue that Amendment 1 is unconstitutional. It tries to do something that the state cannot do because federal law governs in this area.
That court fight went all the way to the state Supreme Court, which affirmed in September the decision to allow the amendment on the ballot. It's the only statewide referendum, and it will show up as a proposed amendment to the 1970 Illinois Constitution. I'm Alex Degman.
Next up on Statewide, we take a look at the records of the two main candidates for Illinois governor. Republican State Senator Darren Bailey is challenging the Democratic incumbent, Governor J.B. Pritzker.
Chicago Sun-Times chief political reporter Tina Svondelis took a look at what Pritzker's done in his first term in office, and WBEZ state politics reporter Dave McKinney evaluated Bailey's 4 years in the Illinois General Assembly. They join me now. Tina, how about we start with you? What have been J.B. Pritzker's biggest achievements in his 4 years in office?
Well, I took a look back at Pritzker entering the political arena in 2017, 5 years ago, when he announced his campaign for governor. And what was striking to me was what he was talking about back then are the same things he's talking about now. And he did point at one thing as a key success that was righting the ship on the state's finances.
We had an unbalanced budget. We had 8 credit downgrades. We had billions of dollars of overdue bills in the state of Illinois. And you can't accomplish much of anything else for the state if you don't solve that problem.
Otherwise, Pritzker did do many of the progressive policy things he said he would do, which is legalizing marijuana, protecting abortion rights, raising the minimum wage, and passing a huge infrastructure package.
Dave, you looked at Darren Bailey's record. How effective has he been during 4 years as a member of the state House and now in the state Senate?
Well, Mary, he was the chief sponsor of 2 bills. One of them increased penalties for illegally passing school buses. The other one was designed to help in the recruitment of firefighters. Now, that's far fewer bills than a lot of his Republican colleagues have passed. And Pritzker says that that shows a lack of productivity, and it proves that Bailey is an ineffective legislator. Now, here's how Bailey responds to that.
If you're going to judge a legislature on the number of bills they got passed, how dare you? Because we need to be a law of less government. We do not need more government. More government, like what J.B. Pritzker wants, it's ruining our society.
I mean, the thing you have to keep in mind here, if you're going to give Bailey the benefit of the doubt, is that Republicans are in the super minority. They just don't have the influence or the votes to do the things that Bailey's been talking about doing.
So on that note, what has Bailey tried to do?
Well, Bailey has mostly tried to emphasize cultural issues. Let's start with abortion. He wants to criminalize the procedure after 20 weeks so doctors would face criminal penalties. He wants to cut off government funding for abortions. But despite pushing for all of that anti-abortion legislation, which went nowhere, he really completely kind of downplayed his ability to restrict abortions if he were to become governor. And I think the reason for that, at least he implied that anyway, was that Democrats would be in control of the legislature.
Governor Pritzker's fear-mongering message that I'm going to destroy the state and take women's rights away, well, he of all people should know that as a governor, I can't do that. The General Assembly, the legislature would have to bring bills and to the table. And I think everyone would agree, number one, nothing's going to change. Women are well protected in Illinois.
He's also proposed reinstating the death penalty, getting rid of the license to own a gun in Illinois, and letting people carry concealed weapons on the CTA. The other thing about Bailey's voting record, all those accomplishments of Pritzker's that Tina rattled off a moment ago, budgets, infrastructure, legalizing cannabis, gambling expansion, the Safety Act that eliminates cash bail, well, Bailey voted against all of those.
Tina, what would you say have been Pritzker's biggest challenges while in office?
Well, after those big legislative wins, he did suffer a huge political loss when voters rejected his proposal to make rich people pay a higher income tax rate. And that had been one of his top priorities. And then the pandemic hit.
Popularity is not something you think about when you're thinking about every day looking at a dashboard, as I did, of how many people died the previous day.
He said that informed his decisions about why to implement the mitigations he did, the school closures, the mask mandates, restaurant restrictions, and those are things that he felt were very important, but it opened him up to a lot of criticism. It opened him up to Republicans calling him an authoritarian, and it also led to other criticisms during the pandemic on how he handled some state agency issues.
You both have covered these two candidates for 4 years now. You both sat down and interviewed them recently about their records. What did they reveal to you about themselves? Tina, let's start with you about J.B. Pritzker.
Well, Pritzker does get very introspective when talking about why he's good at handling crises. And he said it's because it's both personal and professional. It's what happened to his parents. It's being the son of an alcoholic who had to call an ambulance on his mother when he was 10 years old. And also just in his business life. He also talked about how he is very used to handling criticism at this point. He does not necessarily search for mean tweets, but he does not very much handle attacks on his family very well.
And Dave, what did you get out of your time with Darren Bailey?
Mary, I mean, what struck me, I guess, about him was how he talks a lot about doom. He sees Illinois as a state in ruin. And I guess, you know, when you look at this election, maybe that's not surprising since he's a challenger taking on an incumbent. But he really has been running a campaign of resentment. My time with him revealed just how much he feels the way that many downstaters do. He embodies them. A lot of them feel like they're getting steamrolled by Chicago on a lot of issues a lot of the time. And that's what's driving him to take the tack that he does in politics. But, you know, he told me that one thing that he does quite often is that he asks himself, what's he going to tell his grandkids someday about his time in politics? And, you know, the core of that is that he thinks he's exposing the ill in Illinois.
It's a big state. Election day is November 8th. These are state political reporters Dave McKinney of WBEZ and Tinas Fondelis of the Sun-Times.
The FBI is offering some tips to avoid falling victim to hurricane-related scams. Authorities say tragedies like Hurricane Ian lead to the public pulling together to help those in need, but they also say scammers leverage natural disasters to take your money and personal information. Disaster and charity fraud can come in many forms, from emails and social media posts to crowdfunding and phone calls. Among the recommendations, research charities online and through the Better Business Bureau. Only give to charities and groups you know and trust. Use a credit card when making a donation, and always check your financial accounts to make sure the charges are accurate. If you think you're a victim of disaster or charity fraud, report it to the National Center for Disaster Fraud. School during the pandemic has been a unique challenge, especially for students with disabilities who receive accommodations. Peter Medlin reports some of the ways that COVID-19 changed education for some students.
Mario McMinn's eyes start to burn by hour five of staring at screens. He's a high school sophomore who has a visual impairment but isn't blind. But when he and everyone else were forced to learn from home in 2020, it meant his whole day was looking at his iPad and computer.
Well, that was a struggle for me because then when school was over, and then it's time to like actually do the homework that was assigned, which was also digital, my eyes were kind of fried at that point.
His vision teacher got him a tool that helped during remote learning, and he still uses today when he's back in person at school. It's a magnifying glass with a backlight around the size of a flashlight. In some classes, his vision doesn't affect him at all. But in, say, his computer science class, the magnifying glass is great for limiting strain to his eyes.
It was some form of like 3D modeling graphic. Sometimes the print would be super small. Those kind of things don't really come in like larger print or whatever. So that definitely really helped me.
John Agusky was Mario's middle school vision teacher. She teaches kids who are blind or visually impaired from 3 years old all the way through eighth grade. Technology has been a game changer for her students over the past few years and during the pandemic. When it comes to intuitive accessibility, she says iPads have been a welcome change from clunky, expensive Braille or large print books that took forever to be made.
Prior to digital books, our students had to carry around these very large books that had their large print in it and or Braille, which are, you can't even carry a Braille book. There's no way to carry a Braille textbook in it all, in the entirety.
Many of her students use a cane, and teaching mobility skills is crucial. One of her favorite activities was taking her students around downtown Chicago using public transportation. They went to Wrigley Field and tried cool restaurants, and all that was shut down during COVID. And that meant virtual mobility lessons like watching videos of her students practicing with their canes or working on cardinal directions.
Okay, where would you cross the street? How would you pick out landmarks in this area? So when you get to that area, oh, you know what, here is the mailbox. I know that that means that the the house I need to go to is right next door or whatever.
Dusky students are back in person now, and she's in constant communication with their parents and teachers. Sometimes a parent will call about broken glasses or a teacher who handed out an assignment without enlarging the font.
She came home crying today because she couldn't see her math. Or then we just do our magic and work with the teachers and make sure that we get everything done.
Back in person, they can also focus more on expanded core curriculum to help them with daily living skills like cooking. Matthew Murphy is the assistant principal of student services at Bartlett High School. He says things like cooking and intentional trips out into the community were a huge loss during the pandemic for many students. He says he feels like they did a great job finding creative solutions when moving instruction online in the early days of the pandemic, but there were challenges for students who received services.
How do we deliver physical therapy, occupational therapy? How do we deliver those services through an online platform? That is still one that we don't necessarily have a perfect answer.
A lot of times in those situations, they had to send materials to parents and try and coach them through it. Tracy King teaches elementary school students who have intellectual disabilities, many of whom are nonverbal and use wheelchairs. So much of her work involves guiding students hand over hand through writing or pressing down stamps. She sends lots of materials home, but so much of her students' school success learning online was dependent on if they had really good one-on-one parental support.
I had some parents that had three children, and the child in my room was their oldest, so they'd have to go back and forth between classrooms and kids. They couldn't just sit next to, you know, the student hand over hand every minute.
Back in person, safety is still King's top priority. One of her former students died of COVID, and some COVID protocols are still in place.
It is a major concern for me because a lot of them have pulmonary issues, and, you know, this can turn into pneumonia.
They mask and don't share as many materials. They're also understaffed, so it takes exponentially longer to feed the students, reposition them for a new activity, or change diapers. King and her students have also embraced technology more over the past few years.
Like the interactive screens, I put more music in my circle time activities, but really the biggest difference is the time that everything takes to try to keep everyone safe.
She hopes they'll have more time for one-on-one activities and fun lessons like cooking. Last year, they got to do a whole unit on cooking, and King says her typically loud classroom went quiet. They were so focused, engaged, and happy. Mario McMinn says he thinks all students who need accommodations or any kind of support could use some patience and help as school transitions back to quote-unquote normal. I'm Peter Medlin.
We've got more to come on Statewide. Stay with us. You're listening to Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Well, back in 2018, California voters passed an animal welfare ballot measure. It included stricter rules on how hogs are raised in order for their pork to be sold in the state. But two major pork industry groups sued in 2019. They say it would hurt producers' livelihoods and the pork supply chain. As Harvest Public Media's Katie Pikus reports, the U.S. Supreme Court will hear their case next week.
Dwight Mogler raises thousands of pigs on his Northwest Iowa farm.
So we have now stepped into the breeding and gestation barn.
There are long rows of narrow enclosures that separate these female pigs, called sows, from one another. Mogler says when sows are ready to be bred, they get, well, moody, often aggressive.
We try to protect them from each other by housing them in individual pens, also referred to as stalls.
They stay in these stalls while they're bred for up to a week. They can stand up and lie down, but they can't turn around. Under California's Proposition 12, Mogler's breeding stalls are too small, meaning pork from his farm couldn't be sold there.
What we realized is we were going to have to spend multiple million dollars expanding our facilities. We were going to have to implement practices that violated our principles. And after looking at that and not being able to sleep very well, we had to make the conscious decision that we will be susceptible to being discounted, but we cannot comply with Prop 12 standards.
Mogler expects if Prop 12 stands, he'll get a lower price for his pigs from pork processors if they can't sell the meat to California. The question of whether one state can regulate the commerce of others is at the heart of a lawsuit. It was brought by the National Pork Producers Council and the American Farm Bureau Federation against California.
Proposition 12 is unconstitutional.
Michael Formica is a legal strategist for the pork producers. On a recent forum, he said Prop 12 creates a burden on farmers outside of California, a violation of the Constitution's Dormant Commerce Clause, which deals with interstate commerce.
It reaches thousands of miles outside of the state of California, imposes very prescriptive standards on farmers who have no contact with the state of California.
California makes up 13% of the U.S. pork market, and experts disagree whether the entire pork industry would be impacted by Prop 12. Neither California's Attorney General's office nor the Department of Food and Agriculture responded to requests for comment, but the state's court filing says voters who passed the measure with more than 60% of the vote had a legitimate interest in promoting sow welfare and human health. The Humane Society of the U.S. supported the ballot initiative. Josh Balk is the vice president of farm animal protection and says Prop 12 is critical to improving animal treatment.
Confining mother pigs in cages barely larger than their bodies, in a cage so narrow they can't even turn around, is cruel. It's inhumane. And it also leads to public health and food safety issues.
California has few hog operations, meaning most of the pork sold there comes from elsewhere. Roger McGowan is an ag law professor at Washburn University. He says even if Californians are concerned about sow welfare and food safety, the U.S. Supreme Court will weigh whether the law unfairly foists those concerns onto producers outside of the state.
Does California have a legitimate public interest that they can uphold without unduly burdening commerce, or is it clearly excessive?
Back in Iowa, farmer Dwight Mogler says if Prop 12 stands, he worries other states could pass similar ballot initiatives.
My concern is this snowball will get a lot bigger, that our food system will become disrupted, and in the end, the consumer will lose.
An opinion from the court isn't expected until next year. I'm Katie Pikus, Harvest Public Media.
At first glance, the decurrent false aster doesn't look like anything special. The white-petaled flower resembles a small daisy. But in fact, the flower is a threatened species, which now grows almost exclusively along the Illinois River's floodplains. It reaches full bloom from late August through early October. WCBU's Tim Shelley recently went on a survey with employees of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and the Illinois Department of Natural Resources to search for the isolated alcoves where the rare plant thrives.
The roar of insects is the first thing which greets one's ears at the edge of this field in rural Woodford County. It's not far from the Illinois River. The Illinois Department of Natural Resources is meticulously cultivating an environment for native species in this prairie wetland. The tall grasses are peppered with ironweed, swamp milkweed, and other plants indigenous to this habitat. Monarch butterflies and bumblebees dart amongst the flowers collecting nectar. But the mission today is seeking out the threatened decurrent false aster, a small flower referred to by its scientific name of Boltonia by the biologists surveying the field today. Habitat destruction has decimated the decurrent false aster's natural range, but it's believed the little white flowers are submerged somewhere deep within the prairie. The group begins to wade into the ocean of tall grasses.
When we were out here last year, the Boltonia was pretty deep in there.
I figured I was in for an adventure,
yeah.
So I came prepared. Prepared as I can, anyway.
Welcome to our job.
I'm speaking with Emily Hodapp, the private lands biologist with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, who invited me on today's expedition. U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service biologist Scott James says this particular stretch of prairie is a good place to search for Boltonia because it's been subjected to fire management.
A lot of different species, like some sort of what we call disturbance activity, some process that sort of resets the vegetation, like prescribed controlled burning or carefully disking. And what those activities do is just sort of resets the vegetation, and it can stimulate certain species that respond well to that disturbance activity done at a specific time of year.
Hodapp and James are mapping the Boltonia they find on the property via GPS coordinates.
we can show that we have enough areas where Boltonia can thrive and where we are seeing plants continuously year after year, then we can delist it. That's the game plan.
A delisting of the current false aster would mean a victory for naturalists. HODAP says a threatened species listing is a call to action to put in the work to prevent the species extinction. It's much harder for a species to make a comeback once it's considered endangered. If the group is lucky, an endangered rusty-patched bumblebee might also make an appearance somewhere within this protected site. But finding one is easier said than done.
I'm gonna find a bumblebee. It's gonna happen.
Didn't Mike only see one last year?
It was one or two, maybe.
Oh, did he see two?
Yeah, one or two. Or it might have been the same one.
About half an hour into the walk, the team finds its first Boltonia decurrens. Some of the flowers are past their prime already, but some are still in full bloom. Emily Hodab says plants like the Boltonia are teaching biologists a lot about prairie management.
It's a weedy species, right? It comes up and it likes disturbance, and when you look at it, you're like, that's a weed. Like, but I think it's beautiful because weed is in the eye of the beholder, right? But it does well in disturbed areas, and so that's something that we are lacking in a lot of our management, is that we want to keep things, in the past, I guess, it's kind of like we want to keep things pristine, right? Mm-hmm. But we're learning more and more and more that disturbance is necessary for a lot of our species.
Hodap and Scott James hope to demonstrate that controlled prairie burns are an effective strategy to encourage the growth of Boltonia year after year.
And so right now, Boltonia is that's threatened, but because we know a little bit more about it and how we can manage for it, and we've got all the great properties like this where it's doing well, we think that we can delist it eventually. Mm-hmm. Within, I think, our 5-year game plan, I think, is the last time we talked about it. It was like, we hope we can delist it within 5 years. But
and admittedly, you know, I feel it's a very ambitious goal, mm-hmm. but you have to have ambition and you have to have goals and do as much as humanly possible and work with partners to do what we can.
The biologists continue to discover and map out the locations of more Boltonia plants throughout this prairie. While the flowers bloom into October, drier conditions seem to have sparked an earlier fizzling out of the Boltonia in this particular patch. Scott James uses a bug net to temporarily capture bumblebees in a jar for examination, but it seems the rusty patch bumblebee will elude the survey group on this day. Emily Hodap is working with private landowners to restore the natural floodplain habitats along the Illinois River that the current false aster and other wildlife need to thrive. She's also working with groups like the Nature Conservancy and the Wetland Initiative to spread Boltonia seeds at sites where they might do well, like Fulton County's Emaquan Nature Preserve. I'm Tim Shelley.
The Illinois Department of Children and Family Services has been under the microscope for several years as it struggles to adopt the reform measures needed to satisfy a federal consent decree. Edith Brady Lunny produced a series that takes a look at how other states have managed to improve their child welfare systems. She told John Norton some of the states were among a dozen that also were under federal decrees to make things better.
Alabama is one of the few jurisdictions to actually complete a court consent decree. That involved a lot of work on their part, starting with a commitment to reduce the number of children who stay in state care. Nancy Buckner, who is the commissioner of the state's Department of Human Resources, explained how that change took place.
Several years ago, we created an urgency for permanency once a child enters care. We were doing a really good job on safety, getting out there. If children needed to go into foster care, they were going into foster care. Then it was kind of like out of sight, out of mind, you know. So we brought it to the forefront.
So the fewer children that you have in care means that you can allocate more resources, and those can be used for the more high-risk children that you have remaining in your care. So in Alabama, they have made it a high priority from day one to return children home or to find a permanent placement for them?
And I think it's intuitive to say it makes sense that keeping children in the home or returning them sooner is the best option. But are there other reforms that states have put into place to reach that goal?
Well, there's a debate that's going on in many states, including Illinois, about the use of systemic poverty to remove children. In the Alabama model, caseworkers look at how all aspects of the family come into play, because poverty is not considered a valid reason to remove children there. Neglect complaints make up the bulk of the reason that children are removed from care. Physical abuse is a very small number of children when you look at the overall picture in states. So the Alabama director explained it this way.
We assess the whole family in its totality and in an effort to keep that family together. And that's what a good child welfare system should be doing. Foster care should be a last resort, and it should always involve child safety.
So you mentioned Alabama. Edith, is there another state that is making some changes that hopefully making things better?
Yeah, we also looked at North Carolina. That's where they have a network of review committees at the county level that look at child welfare cases from their communities. An annual report of that review is provided to the county board and the state. It's been very successful in its involvement of a multidisciplinary team where you have more eyes and more views to see what happens to a child and their family. And it also adds a layer of community buy-in. Local child welfare advocates know what's happening with their local children.
Well, speaking of local, you spoke with Associate Judge Amy McFarland about a proposed family treatment court. How would that help families?
Well, if this court is established, the family treatment court would bring a range of services to families who have come to the attention of child welfare. This would be in addition to the so-called problem-solving courts that we have in the 11th Judicial Circuit. The substance abuse, employment, housing issues, all those things that impact a family's ability to care for their children would be addressed. Judge Brian Goldrick would be the presiding judge over this court if it's is approved. And like the drug court and the mental health court and the veterans courts that exist now in the 11th Judicial Circuit, there will be a team of specialists that will be available to help the families. And this civil court will be unlike a criminal court. The sanctions or the rewards in this court will be parenting time.
Okay, now, it's, you know, I don't think it's a surprise that there are a number of critics of the agency, and they say that the DCFS needs a complete overhaul. But DCFS is saying we're making progress. What are the chances the state will be able to make these meaningful changes?
One thing child welfare leaders in these other states pointed to as a factor in their successes was a stable and strong leadership. DCFS has had 30 leaders over the past 58 years since it was established. During the most recent decade, there were 10 directors. And the current director, Mark Smith, can only be described as embattled at this point. With every child death case where DCFS had previous involvement and the same pattern of failures emerge, I think the public just loses confidence in DCFS. And so far, the governor has shown no signs of replacing Smith.
So, Edith, what do you think comes next for DCFS and that federal lawsuit that has been out there for, what, 30 years now?
Right. Well, the ACLU, which is the group that filed the lawsuit on behalf of minors who are in state care, told me that they are hopeful that agreement will be reached on what needs to be done to fulfill a consent decree. And a consent decree is an agreement that both sides make on what should be done to fix a problem. And those consent decrees can be in place for decades, and they are in place in decades for many states. The fact that a consent decree is issued just means that the work will continue to correct the problems. So there's a hearing October 28th in federal court to discuss those plans for Illinois.
Edith Brady-Lunny talking with John Norton. She's produced a series on how to reform the Department of Children and Family Services, and we'll hear more from her next week here on Statewide. Just ahead, a story of addiction and recovery. We'll be back in just a moment. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. As drug and overdose deaths are on the rise, Gateway Foundation is working to get out the message that recovery is possible. A Southern Illinois native, Shane Hassler, battled addiction to heroin for 20 years before seeking treatment at the Gateway Foundation Springfield Recovery Center. Sober since 2015, Hassler, now of Chicago, dedicates his professional life to helping others, in part by setting an example of recovery. He was hired by the nonprofit as a recovery coach, and he now oversees online recovery resources. He spoke to reporter Maureen McKinney about his addiction and way out.
What was your drug or drugs of choice?
Well, ultimately, it was heroin, right? So, but that didn't start until I was almost 30 years old. So from the time I was a teenager through my 20s, it was alcohol, marijuana, and cocaine occasionally, and just things kind of just kept escalating as time went on. But ultimately, what led me to seek treatment was heroin.
How old were you when you started using drugs and alcohol?
In the very beginning, like 16, and I didn't establish a firm foundation in recovery until I was 38. So it was a good 22 years of mind-altering substances. Yeah.
What sort of factors influence your use and addiction?
Early on, it was about like becoming a part of something, right? I felt like isolated as a teenager, right? And I found these group of guys that were, you know, like-minded people or whatever. We weren't playing sports. We weren't like into academics. We were just kind of like these, you know, I don't know, laid back kind of guys. And that was like drinking beer and smoking pot on the weekends. And I felt like I had become part of a community, right? And so how I operated under the influence was different, you know, looking back than them. I early on, I started blacking out from drinking, and I wouldn't stop. But I never, like, I was able to go through school, and I was able to hold down a job, and I never really perceived it as a problem. And then as things kind of escalated, and, you know, I was in my 30s, and I was sitting in a house by myself, completely alone and isolated because of my drug use, I was like, this is not what I signed up for. This isn't what, by the end of it, I had done completely opposite of what I wanted. But it was like that, the addiction aspect of it, that just kept driving more and more. And, you know, I was trying to get higher and higher, and I was trying to escape. It became this like vicious cycle of a snake eating its own tail. I was trying to escape the world that I created, and the only way I could do that in my mind was temporary, by doing more drugs. And so until I finally just, you know, had enough, I guess.
What was the turning point that got you into recovery?
Let's see, I didn't start using heroin until probably 2006-ish, 2005, somewhere in there. I started going to residential treatment. I went the first time in 2009, so it was pretty quick that I realized that I needed to stop, otherwise there was going to be ramifications for my lifestyle, right? Like, things were falling apart pretty quickly. And then it was like the first time I went voluntarily, and then there was like criminal justice involved just because of the lifestyle. So I was court mandated to go a couple times. So I first went in 2009, and I didn't, you know, my sobriety date now is in 2015. So there was 6 years of knowing I needed to stop and whatever. But ultimately, the in recovery community, they say every time you go back out, it gets worse. And I had had a girlfriend that committed suicide in our apartment while I was sleeping. Same, she was also dealing with her own addiction, and that was kind of like, you know, I feel bad saying it, but, you know, I have to try and stay positive that, you know, that was the event that saved my life, even though she lost hers, you know. So, you know, having already known that I needed to get help, and then getting to that point, I was like, okay, now we really need to just, because that was going to be my fate too, you know, like I knew. And I reached out to a family member, and I was like, if I don't get help, I'm going to die. It kept escalating, you know.
Yeah. die one way or the other, probably.
Yeah. You know, then they say that in the 12 steps or whatever, you know, there's three outcomes, jails, institutions, or death. And I had already gone to jail and treatment, which is an institution. So, yeah, like those, it's kind of inevitable that those are the outcomes, you know.
I know young people who've died of heroin overdoses. I feel a little familiar with what you're talking about.
Well, yeah, and that's a good example. You know, like I talk about my experience fairly openly because most people have somebody that they know or you know, close to them that has dealt with addiction or lost somebody due to addiction or alcohol abuse or something. So, you know, and that I feel like the more people openly talk about it, it kind of alleviates some of that shame and guilt for people that are dealing with an addiction, that they can come out and say, look, I also am struggling with that. So, like, what can I do?
And it's a disease.
Yeah, yeah.
It's, can you speak to that, how it's not a fault?
Yes. It is a disease, right? It has to be managed. It's like, you know, like cancer or diabetes. It's not, there's not a cure, but you can take steps on a daily basis to kind of manage that, right? And so it's a disease of the brain. And it's a daily thing where you have to, like, you know, pay attention to what's going on. You know, like if you were diagnosed with cancer or diabetes, where you're not just going to be like, okay, whatever, I'm just going to let it go. You know, there's, you know, a lot of people that want some sort of instant fix to this, but it's not that. It's like going, you know, like with the cancer example, right? You go to doctor's appointments and get your treatments or whatever. And for somebody in recovery, that's just like talking to people that are understanding and people that are supportive and making sure that you're doing things to address your mental and emotional health as well as your spiritual and physical.
What do you say to people who are battling addiction and how they can get help?
Well, you know, I'm a Gateway alumni. I work at Gateway. You know, I think Gateway is open. They have a 24-hour hotline. And the number is 855-925-GATE. And that would be a start, right? And just get information on how to get into treatment. And that's usually like the biggest barrier is just making that initial call. Or that ask. In my case, I had been to treatment numerous times, and I knew how to do that. But then I was so isolated because of the lifestyle that I had lived. You know, calling a family member. I called my cousin, who was 10 years older than me, and I had seen her maybe 3 times in the previous 5 years. And each time she saw me, she'd just start crying. Well, I hadn't really talked to her, but I knew she cared, right? And picking up that phone to make that phone call was not easy, even at that point. But I told her, I was like, I need help. And so she, you know, she didn't have much of a knowledge base of recovery or addiction, and she was willing to learn. And that was important too, you know, finding people that are willing to learn and go along with you on this journey. You know, there's a lot of people that kind of like cast you aside, and it's like, your problem. Come back to me when you're fixed or whatever. And that's detrimental.
So family was a help for you and can be for others?
Yeah, it can be. I mean, but they're also like, you know, obviously family relationships and interpersonal relationships vary, you know, mm-hmm. and sometimes those family relationships aren't healthy to begin with. So, but it's being able to, like, maybe your brother's supportive, but your sister is not. So kind of like figuring that out and kind of like meeting them where they're at. If they're not interested in helping and they want you to fix it on your own, then call somebody else and be like.
Are there other aspects of your lived experience that you can use to help others?
I mean, that's kind of like what I do at Gateway now is I share my experience with current clients and, you know, having had experience with the criminal justice system and DCFS and overdose and suicide. And, you know, I don't share graphic details typically, but having that understanding, I feel like even when I was in treatment, some of the counselors and people that worked at Gateway and other treatment centers that I really responded to were people that had that real-world lived experience because they have an understanding of what it's like. Like, I know I need to stop. I know I need to stop using, but like, whatever it was, I kept going back, right? And that's that addiction part. And really to understand that, you know, that real, real lived experience is impactful.
Do you have children?
And I do. I do have two adult daughters now. They're ages 21 and 26. And they dealt with a lot, you know, growing up. And I'm even a grandfather now. I have a two-year-old granddaughter. I'm grateful that they were both very forgiving and were able to look past some of that stuff, because they could have been very resentful and they could have like shut me out because I wasn't there for them when they were growing up, for a good portion of it, you know. And even recently I celebrated 7 years in recovery, and my younger daughter texted me and she's like, you know, I love you, congratulations, you know, I don't know where I would be if you wouldn't have done this. Oh. Right? And so to put that in perspective for me, that was very powerful, right? Because it wasn't just about me. I needed to do it for myself, but to have those sort of like ripple effects with the people around me, you know, because those bad things were doing that to them. So now the good things are having that ripple effect. So
yeah. Are there misconceptions about addiction that you've run across?
Yeah, I mean, one of the common misconceptions, especially with heroin, right? So like, whenever I tell somebody that I was actively used heroin, they were like, oh, I could have never done that. I could never use a needle. Well, that's a misconception, right? You don't have to use a needle to do heroin. You can smoke it, you can snort it, you can eat it, whatever. So the knowledge base isn't there, you know, and the misconception that it is kind of like a moral failing, like just stop, you know, or whatever. It's still out there. I think as time goes on, even through my experience over the past 10 or 15 years, it's less, you know, that stigma has kind of lessened, but it's still there. Like for people that are in recovery, there's offensive words out there, like the word, you know, junkie or whatever. It kind of demoralizes people and makes them unhuman. Words can be hurtful, but we're working on it. We're working on it.
What made you want to be a recovery coach?
It was kind of interesting. I mean, this is how it happened. I'm originally from Southern Illinois, and I came to treatment in Springfield. And then after I was sober for a little while, I moved to Chicago. Even though I had a master's degree, I was finishing my master's degree when I first got introduced to heroin. But then, you know, my life started kind of like falling apart. And I had this master's degree and wasn't putting it to use. And I, you know, because of my criminal history and stuff like that, I was working in a restaurant that doesn't require like background checks and those types of things typically. And I was just talking to family members and actually somebody that I had known from recovery that worked at Gateway. And they were like, man, you could really, you know, help people if you told them your story. So I, you know, just kind of like on a whim applied at Gateway up near Chicago, and here I am. Yeah. So now it's been a few years later.
Tell me about your current job and how you came into it.
Yeah, so originally I was hired at Gateway under a grant called the Digital Toolkit, and the idea was behind it, and this was pre-COVID, that in the world we lived in, a lot of it is digital. So why shouldn't recovery be the same way? Keep people connected in like a digital world. And so it was supposed to be a pilot program that started in 2019, and then COVID hit, and it kind of like exponentially grew. It went from a pilot program to a program that we launched across the state of Illinois. And over the past few years, I went from a recovery coach to recovery support coordinator to a program manager, and now I'm a program director for digital service. Partially is because of timing. I mean, because if it wasn't for COVID, I don't know if it would have grown so fast, you know, but I also have that real world lived experience, which is, you know, powerful for the clients. And then, you know, I have the education that I received before I went into treatment and got into recovery. So it was like a kind of like a perfect storm. Ultimately, with recovery and people that are suffering from addiction, right, they're still people. A lot of people want to cast them aside. To get somebody into recovery, you got to keep them alive. You know, with the fentanyl in the society today, it's hard. You know, people are overdosing when they're not even doing heroin because they're mixing fentanyl and other drugs. And for somebody to actually establish a foundation in recovery, they need to be alive.
That's Shane Hassler. He's Gateway Foundation's virtual program director. He spoke with Maureen McKinney about his own struggles with heroin addiction. That's all the time we have for Statewide. Be sure to join us next week. We'll be back with more reports and conversations from in and around Illinois. All of our episodes are available at the website nprillinois.org. Just look for Statewide. And you can also listen to our weekly podcast through the NPR One app. I'm Sean Crawford. Statewide is a production of NPR Illinois, with help from other Illinois Public Radio stations.